What's up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Rico Adavans, also known as Rico France. And a great episode for you today. What a great lineup of guests I've been having of late. I've been truly, truly lucky to be able to get these guests on and have so many awesome, courageous guests on of late. And today is no different. Somebody that you might be familiar with, Dr. Scott Jensen. He had a couple videos that went viral because he was the outspoken doctor who started discussing his issues with the CDC guidelines in regards to death certificates, and then kind of going into how these numbers could be possibly inflamed and all this stuff. And I'm sure you've seen him on Fox News and many other places being interviewed and asked. So we go into his story and just what happened, how the media reacted to it, and then we start dissecting the coronavirus and certain details about it. We talk about masks. We talk about a lot of really intriguing, important topics. So you guys will definitely enjoy this conversation if you're not sick of hearing a coronavirus. But this, his story is super important. And like I said, he's super courageous for being outspoken and dealing with the backlash and all the extra stress on his life that he probably didn't need. Couple other news updates. We have another Union of the Unwanted show on the 31st. Remember that. Follow us on all our social media accounts. So, and then you can get those links immediately. RV36 on Instagram, RV36 on Twitter, RV36 on Parler, RV36 on YouTube. If you want to watch the video version of this episode, go on our YouTube channel. You can look up RV36 or just search Ripple Effect Podcast. You'll find my YouTube channel and you'll see the video version of Dr. Scott Jensen and myself. And I put in the show descriptions, I put links to all my social media accounts, a bunch of other stuff like my PayPal account, which you can use to send me money for a shirt if you want one of the new Ripple Effect Podcast shirts. My wife also has Vimeo. I think you can use that also. So if you message me, let me know you want a shirt. We'll find a way to get you one regardless where you are in the world. We'll send you one even if we lose money, which we've already had done a few times, is send out shirts to people that the shipping cost was more than the shirts. But we also have a Patreon page, which if you want to support the show, you can. $1 a month, whatever you can contribute is very much appreciated. I am working very hard to make this gig my full-time gig. So I've talked a little bit to Rockfin in regards to maybe doing a show there. I'm also dealing with this other company that works with Podomatic called What For Apparel in regards to opening up a store where I can sell Ripple Effect Podcast apparel. I'm doing all this stuff. Honestly, I wish that I just had enough Patreon supporters and I could just focus on the show, because all these other things kind of take up a little bit of time, you know, to take care of. But for the time being, I'm going to kind of explore all avenues in regards to getting a little closer to doing this full time. If I can make enough to pay the bills and do something that I find super important, then what else can I ask for, right? I mean, I got a beautiful family, got a beautiful life in regards to, you know, health and people I love around me. And if I could do something fulfilling, something that I truly love for a living, then why not? And also, I know a lot of other podcasters have contacted me in regards to doing interviews and stuff like that. So keep up with my YouTube channel. I have a interview playlist where you can watch all my interviews I've done. So I'll be throwing those interviews, if they're on YouTube, I'll be throwing them in that playlist. So do that. And I think that's it for now. Enjoy the show. Peace. Thank you so much for being with me. And your video went viral. For people who I mean, you, I think some people might be familiar with your name, your face. They've seen the video go get around a little bit. One thing I talk a lot about on this show is how my issue with censorship, and how in all other circumstances, getting a second opinion from a doctor is completely acceptable and fine. But during this whole crisis, if you hear a second opinion that goes against the grain or goes against the mainstream narrative, it was immediately being suppressed and we're having issues with it. And which I had a huge problem with, because the way I look at it is doctors, just like anybody else, I mean, you look at information, you analyze it, you give your best perspective on that information. And it doesn't, I mean, in most cases, not every mechanic is going to agree on what's wrong with a car. Not everybody's going to agree on what's wrong with a person, you know, diagnose them the same way. So that's a huge, huge issue. But for people who are listening who might not be familiar with your story, might not be familiar with how you got caught up in this media firestorm of criticism of I think from one side getting criticized, from the other side I think being praised from a lot of friends of mine and people who are in the alternative media community. They love what you're doing, your willingness to be outspoken. But people who aren't familiar with your story, can you kind of go into what happened? What were you doing prior to maybe the COVID hysteria, and then what you saw and what you were what you try to, I guess, just discuss, really, because you weren't really trying to cause too many issues. You were kind of just stating your opinion, and then what happened from there?
I'd be glad to, and thank you for having me on, Ricardo. Basically, I've been in the Senate for 4 years, and I've had the honor and privilege to carry some big legislation. I carried a licensure bill for the pharmacy benefit managers, and they've worked in the dark, if you will. They use gag clauses, and they've made it very difficult for pharmacies and for patients to know what's going on. So that was a big bill. And then I carried an insulin safety net bill. So I've had a good relationship with my colleagues. In fact, with the insulin safety net bill, Governor Walz invited me over to his office, and we had a private conversation where we talked about how could we get this done with a Democratic House, a Republican Senate, and a Democratic governor. And we got it done. And we got it passed in both the House and Senate, and Governor Walz signed it into law. So I feel like I've had a very focused and productive Senate term. But on April 3rd, I received a communication from the Minnesota Department of Health. And this was now about 4 to 6 weeks into COVID-19 for Minnesota. And in that communication, I was given advice as to how I should go about utilizing COVID-19 as a diagnosis in regards to the certification of death. And it felt to me like I was being coached or massaged. And I didn't feel right about it at all. I've been doing death certificates for 35 years, and I understand what the mechanism should be and how important the underlying cause of death is, and how a precise sequence of causation is really the high point in completing a death certificate. We should try to find the initiating event. What did that lead to? Which led to what? Which led to what? Which led to death? And when we do that, that's where we end up diagnosing that the underlying cause of death might have been colon cancer or a heart attack or emphysema. But in this situation, we were being encouraged that if COVID-19 was thought to possibly be or probably be, or we assume that it was a part of it, we should put COVID-19 as a cause of death. And it went on to specifically say that if COVID-19 was considered a contributing factor, to go ahead and use it as a cause of death. But if other things were contributing factors like emphysema or asthma, we should put that in the contributing condition box part two, which is where normally I would have put it. But it's also where I normally would put COVID-19 if I thought COVID-19 was simply a contributing event, but perhaps it was a motor vehicle accident or alcohol poisoning or a heart attack or a pulmonary embolus that caused the death. So I didn't feel good about this. And a few days later on a TV interview, I made the comment that I didn't think it was right. And that comment to Chris Berg on a TV show led to the next night I was on with Laura Ingraham on the Ingraham Angle on Fox cable news. And during that conversation, she asked, well, why would there be a push to do this? And I made the comment that sometimes financial incentives can play a role. And that really raised a ruckus. And I had the statistics, so I was able to share that if a hospital is normally going to get paid $5,000 as a bundled payment for a Medicare patient for a standard respiratory infection, if the respiratory infection were identified as COVID-19, that $5,000 would jump up to $13,000. And if during the hospitalization a ventilator was utilized, then the $13,000 would jump to $39,000. And you can imagine all hell broke loose at this point. Physicians were contacting me saying that I was besmirching the profession of medicine. And all I was trying to do was tell people data quality matters. If we're going to do case fatality counts and base policy decisions off that, we need to be as precise as we can. We need to all be on the same page. We need to be comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges. And above all, we need to make certain that we don't fracture the public trust. And this is what I thought was happening. So it went from there, and fast forward a couple months, and all of a sudden I found myself receiving a letter from the Board of Medical Practice in Minnesota saying that I was being investigated because when I compared COVID-19 to influenza epidemics, I was providing reckless advice, according to one accuser. And another accuser said that I was spreading misinformation by questioning the Department of Health and their advice regarding the completion of death certificates. So that required a 30 to 40 hour investment of time to put together a response of 5,000 words and 70 pages of attachments. And I sent that to the Board of Medical Practice. And then I decided that I needed to go public with what was happening, because it felt like, because I was giving some attention to a narrative other than just the conventional narrative, other than just do what you're told, I felt like I was on the hot seat. So I went ahead and I did a video and put it out on July 5th. And I did that in part because I felt like this is so important that literally we wanted this conversation to take place globally. But also I felt it was important that the media not get a chance to shape how this story unfolded. It needed to be shaped by every man, every woman, John Doe, Jane Doe, everywhere. And unbeknownst to me, I didn't realize how wild it would get, but some 20 million people saw the video and it did indeed go viral. And there was a very good discussion taking place over the month of July. And then toward the end of July, I was notified by the Board of Medical Practice that the board had done a thorough investigation and had reconsidered my response and had looked at the initial anonymous complaints. At least they were anonymous to me, and they had dismissed the charges. So that sort of brings us up to speed.
Yeah. And one thing, when I started seeing interviews with you and you were talking about the importance of death certificates, that's something that a lot of us never really even took in consideration, right? Like how it affects funding and statistics, government statistics on how they want to handle certain crises, if something is a crisis or not. So that's, I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense how important it is for those things to be accurate. You know, a lot of people have been making the flu comparison to coronavirus pandemic. Do you still think, looking back, do you still think it's a fair comparison?
I do. And in the New England Journal of Medicine, right around April 1st, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Mike Osterholm, a well-known epidemiologist, wrote an article. And actually, I take that back. Dr. Osterholm was not an author. It was Dr. Fauci was a chief author, and Dr. Robert Redfield from the CDC was a contributing author in the New England Journal of Medicine. And basically, what Dr. Fauci said was the more data that was coming forth was demonstrating that the COVID-19 pandemic was behaving very much like an aggressive influenza epidemic. And this was Dr. Fauci's words. And Dr. Osterholm had also made comments that the COVID-19 pandemic was behaving like some of the flu epidemics that we have seen. So that was absolutely a comparison that was being made around the country. And if you think about it, a COVID-19 is a single-stranded RNA respiratory virus. And that's what influenza is, a single-stranded RNA respiratory virus. These have no comparability to Ebola virus or syphilis or tuberculosis or even, if you will, to shingles. They're comparable to one another because they're similar. Coronaviruses have been in our society and embedded within our DNA for decades. So to make a comparison between the two is very logical and very reasonable. They're not the same. I believe that COVID-19 is indeed a new novel virus. But I think to make a comparison, to provide a context, so that when we talk about such and such number of deaths in the United States from COVID-19, it's appropriate to know that in 2018, from the influenza epidemic that we had that year, we had 80,000 deaths. I think it's also appropriate to know that in the 2009 swine flu epidemic, we had some 60 million Americans get the swine flu. We were very fortunate that the 2009 swine flu did not have the fatality rate that some of the other epidemics have had. But I think when we connect the dots by providing context and providing pertinent comparisons, then we help people say, oh, okay, I get that. And then they think for themselves and they don't become overwhelmed with fear. And I don't like people to be afraid. I want people to know that they can think things through and they can ask questions. They're very, very capable of that. I don't like paralyzing people's ability to think through fear and a demand that you engage in some sort of groupthink process. That's where we go wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I always make the argument, regardless what the issue is, let people get all sides, every perspective, and let them be the judge. I mean, if somebody, you know, I've said this, it's kind of a silly example, but if I want to watch a 2-hour documentary on flat earth, on argument about how, then I should have the right to watch that and then decide afterwards how silly it was. But at least I should have the right to watch it. So, you know, and like I open up this podcast talking about how it's quite common in all other circumstances to be completely okay and acceptable to get a second opinion on a diagnosis. A doctor having a different opinion than another doctor is not something frowned upon. It's just like, okay, they're looking at it. They're seeing something that he's not seeing or vice versa. So it was, I think that's the thing that scared a lot of people in the alternative media community, especially myself, was when I started seeing people like yourself who were just sharing different ideas, different perspectives, nothing dangerous. You weren't promoting violence. You weren't, nothing like that. And your information is being suppressed. And then the media, the way the media handled it, you know, even though Dr. Birx, during a press conference, said they were being very liberal with their coronavirus accounts. So a lot of this stuff, it's funny when you say it or somebody else says it, then it gets suppressed on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, all this stuff. But yet when Dr. Birx says it out in the open, there, and there's tons of other examples of people saying like, hey, we're counting things with the virus and by the virus, as you know, we're lumping those all together. I mean, that's concerning. I mean, the CDC website itself says that even when you do test positive for a coronavirus or the coronavirus, they can't specify, right? If it was the coronavirus, the strain of coronavirus that actually causes COVID-19, or if it's one of the many coronaviruses in the coronavirus family, right? Like the testing is still very, I guess the accuracy of it, which means if the accuracy of it is still very questionable, I shouldn't say of it because there's quite a few of them. But if the testing, we haven't found a accurate test that we feel confident in, then that means the numbers we can't really put much faith in, which means this whole lockdown and all this overwhelming change in our whole society should all be questioned.
Well, to your point, I think Dr. Redfield, the CDC, recently was quoted as saying that, yes, with some of the policy decisions that have been done, we indeed have created a potential financial incentive to ramp up the use of COVID-19 as a diagnosis. So I think your point is spot on in that regard. In regards to testing in and of itself, this is something I intend to do a video on in the near future, because I think with the recent 77 NFL football players all having positive tests and then all finding out that they're false positives, I think the whole notion of testing is just a mess. And when that happens, one of the first things to go is the public trust. And if we're going to have a coordinated, effective response on the part of all Americans and on part of all the citizens of the earth, there has to be some trust. And the trust has indeed been fractured. So from my perspective, I think that I hate to call myself the purveyor of a contrarian narrative. I'm just trying to talk about some facts. And I think the idea that people sort of want to cancel me out or muzzle me, I mean, that was one of the big reasons why I thought that I needed to go public too, was in addition to what I'd said earlier, I felt like if this could happen to me, I mean, I'm just a Joe Blow family doc in Minnesota, you know, in a town of 4,000 or 5,000 people. And I just try to do my job and I love my patients. But if I'm going to be targeted and all of a sudden have the Board of Medical Practice make a decision as to whether or not my medical license will remain valid, well, then couldn't that happen to almost anybody that requires some sort of a reporting agency or a certificate agency or a licensing agency if they were targeted? And I don't care if you're a teacher or a nurse or a hairstylist. If you have to be certified by some board or agency and someone targets you and goes to that board or agency and says that they don't like the way you wear your shoes, or they don't like this or that, and all of a sudden you're on the hot seat, then I think everybody needs to understand that if it can happen to me, it could happen to anybody. And I think that's why I'm so gratified that people have indeed been engaged. I hope I didn't deflect your comment or question, Ricardo, regarding testing, but the testing is really right now an absolute mess. I mean, people need to understand we have serology testing, which is blood testing, where we look in the rear view mirror to see if a person's had it. That's generally not what we're looking for when we do the test on people who are acutely ill or people who were trying to screen and get ready for surgery or something like that. That's a PCR test. And those PCR tests do involve a step where whatever strand or snippet of COVID-19 virus that is utilized, it will be amplified. And one of the questions we always need to remember is, just because we have a snippet or a piece of a COVID-19 virus identified on that person, that does not mean that that virus is able to be replicated or infectious. And these are the things that people are confused about.
Absolutely. And the thing is, everything's become so political, right? I mean, like, if I don't wear a mask, it must be because I'm a Trump supporter. If I do wear a mask, it must be because I'm a Biden supporter. It has nothing to do with, like, just the science behind it or just personal choice. It's a shame because, you know, it's, science is supposed to be, you know, in a lot of cases and probably incorrectly, science is put on this pedestal where it's like, it doesn't have a political party. It doesn't have an agenda. It just looks at the facts. But it's science, a lot, it's studies, research, it's all run by people, and people have flaws, right?
Ricardo, talk about science. Basically, when we talk about science, science is science, and scientists are the ones getting political, not science. Science is a pure study, and there are three steps to science. And I think we need to remember them. First thing we do is we observe. The second thing is we measure. And then we create a hypothesis. And those three steps take place. And we devise experiments to determine whether our hypothesis is correct or not. We sit under an apple tree. An apple falls down. It hits the ground. What does Newton say? Huh, the apple fell down. It didn't fall up. He made an observation. Then he measured how many apples fell to the ground rather than sailed up in the sky. Then he created a hypothesis. I think there must be some force that pulls it to the ground. And we end up with, if you will, gravity. This is science. Now, scientists have become more political, and I think we need to understand why. Scientists are very dependent on dollars. Dollars are given out to people who successfully fill out grants or who successfully get news media coverage, who get above the fold coverage on a study that is half baked and not ready. That's why the Journal of the American Medical Association recently had an article talking about how over the last 3 months, we have had so much, quote, research mushed together, crammed together, and published. And it's published without the value or the benefit of randomized controlled trials, without double-blinded studies, without that terribly important thing called peer review. Peer review isn't something that happens in a matter of days or weeks. Peer review is something that happens in months and years. We need to look at data, hypotheses, conclusions, and say, hey, did it just get done here? Or did they also reproduce this study in Arizona and Florida and England and Warsaw, Poland? Because if it didn't, it might be flawed. There might be an intrinsic prejudice or bias that nobody realized was being introduced. Or maybe it wasn't unintentional. Maybe it was to get in a position where more dollars could flow in. This is where scientists and doctors should be held accountable. We have become more political. When I started med school in 1978, I remember grand rounds. This was not a kumbaya moment where we all got together and slapped each other on the back and say, hey, Dr. Jensen, great diagnosis. This was where we got together and looked at puzzling cases, patients that didn't really fit the mold. And we discussed and argued and talked about, what about this? What about this? What about this? This is what we used to be about. Today, we have physicians attacking other physicians because they don't like the narrative they're sharing. I fear for the very essential nature of medicine. We are a compromised profession, and I don't know if we can walk this back.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, how much of the oxychloroquine discussion and demonization was political, do you think?
I don't know how you quantify that, but I know that when I look at hydroxychloroquine, I've been using that medicine for my patients for some 35 years. My wife was on it for 15 years with her arthritis variant. I think that to demonize it made no sense at all. I understand that there may have been various public speakers jumping to conclusions, but I would ask the question, was it jumping to conclusions, or was it trying to provide some measure of hope, or was it trying to do some public brainstorming saying, hey, we've found some evidence that this might work and this might do it? I mean, we're doing the same thing with the vaccine that Gilead or some of these other companies, I've forgotten the names of the various companies. I think Sanofi might be working on one. But we've had people come out and share very hopeful messages that might in a different context be said to be spreading misinformation that's delusional and not real. If you look at our track record for creating successful, highly effective vaccines to respiratory viruses, we don't have that great a track record. So I think we need to be a little bit chill on this and just say, hey, hold it. If Australians are saying ivermectin has some value, if someone in Texas is saying budesonide has some value, if hydroxychloroquine is identified in some countries in Europe as potentially having value, particularly in the first phase of the disease, I think we can honor that by having an intelligent scientific discussion. We don't need to demonize people, vilify people. And in the same way, we can look at remdesivir. But I think it's appropriate to look at remdesivir and say, this is a drug that's never been approved by the FDA for anything. It has been given an emergency use authorization. It is a highly charged potential medication that could drive profits for Gilead and Gilead shareholders to the moon. It's $3,000 plus for each course of disease. It's used only in the latter part of the disease. So if you have COVID-19 and you're not getting better, you're not getting bad enough to go in the hospital, you're sort of told to sit in limbo and wait to get better or get really sick, and then we'll put you in the hospital and do all these things. And at some point in time, this seems like the most bizarre, twisted, mean-spirited catch-22 any human could ever devise.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the thing is, the fact that they're okay with pushing a drug that has never been FDA approved, and yet hydroxychloroquine has been around for a long time, FDA approved, people use for off-label uses. I mean, it's of course it has some side effects. People who say, oh, well, you know, every single drug on the market has side effects. That's why during these commercials, when they're selling you prescription drugs, there's a long list at the end of the commercial of things it may cause. I mean, so it's not, I mean, the fact that we shouldn't even consider it because somebody somewhere might have some side effect. I mean, I always make the argument, listen, peanut butter is delicious to most of us, but is murder to some of us. It doesn't mean that peanut butter isn't necessarily the most vicious, dangerous thing ever. It just means people have a different reaction to the same thing sometimes. So it's, you know, oh, did you want to add something?
Yeah, let me ask you a question. What do you think aspirin and quinine have in common?
I don't know.
They both come from the bark of a tree. They were not manufactured in some pharmaceutical laboratory. Quinine is one of the basic root molecules of hydroxychloroquine. Quinine is used for nocturnal night cramps. It's been used for a variety of things. But both quinine and aspirin are products that were identified from a bark of a tree. So I think that we need to just step back and say, hey, why would we demonize hydroxychloroquine with such vehemence? We're talking about a drug that when you take it like my wife did, twice a day for weeks, months, and years on end, yeah, you will check the retina of your eye once a year. You will watch to make sure there's no cardiac disturbances. But we're talking about literally using 200 milligrams twice a day for a week or two, coming nowhere close to any kind of studied toxic amount of hydroxychloroquine being used, and yet people are getting fired from their jobs for talking about this and presenting a different narrative to the fact that maybe we could do some different studies, and maybe the studies that didn't find value to hydroxychloroquine, maybe they were flawed studies. Maybe the product was introduced late in the game. Maybe if it had been introduced earlier, it might have had value. But again, physicians and scientists need to lead the way to an intellectual conversation. where we don't demonize one another. We talk to each other.
Yeah, well, even with the hospital thing, you know, the inflating numbers. I mean, in a way, I feel bad for some hospitals that were doing that because they were laying everybody off. I mean, I know people who work at local hospitals. Hospitals were dead because you told one, you scared everybody into going to the hospital. And two, if it wasn't life or death, people weren't going. So there's a lot of people who were doing typical, you know, everyday x-rays, MRIs and whatnot that just had nothing to do. So, I mean, I can kind of see the incentive in like, hey, let's, you know, if we can get a little extra money, keep us afloat, why not? You know, and that's not to say that they probably didn't do everything in their power to keep somebody alive. It just means that maybe after they're gone, if they, you know, I can see that incentive. And I think most people can. And I don't think it was necessarily even always, you know, some evil plan or whatnot. But yeah, I mean, the hydroxychloroquine thing, is there, so I know when I had Dell on my show not too long ago, we were talking to Dell Bigtree, which I know he's interviewed you also. We talked about how, like, if there isn't a alternative treatment for COVID-19, then they can fast track a vaccine. Is that true? Is that, you think that could be some of the motivation that if there was something that showed promise and could be considered a treatment for COVID-19, then they wouldn't be able to fast track a vaccine? Is that true or not? Do you know of that?
I can't answer that question with certainty, but I would be inclined to disagree with that. I think that this is an all-out, we've got to do whatever we can. I think President Trump and I think governors around the country, I know that there's a certain concern that there could be game playing in the back rooms. But quite frankly, if we found that hydroxychloroquine was a treatment that worked in 40% of people if utilized in the first 5 to 7 days of symptomatic disease, I don't think that that would in any way, shape, or form necessarily slow down the production of a vaccine. The production of a vaccine is a very complex process, and what's going to slow it down is human trials, because we're going to need to see, are we getting the antibody response that we want? Are we getting the right kind of antibodies? Are we getting antibodies that, if you will, allow an anamnestic response on the part of the cells in the body to, if you will, crank them up when they need them, those kinds of things. So I don't think it would really slow it down. But I've heard that message, and I guess I just can't go there, because I think that we need to get over this as soon as we can. I don't think the lockdowns are appropriate. I don't think that's where we should be going, but I understand that some people think they are. And I think all of us would agree that once we get on the other side of COVID-19, we can maybe have a more measured conversation about the results of lockdowns and school closures and masks, because it seems right now that we're really struggling as a scientific community, as a medical community, as a community of people. We're struggling to have honest conversations. And so everybody's picking and choosing whatever news they want to pick. Some people pick it from over here. Some people pick it from over there. They demonize one another's sources. I come out and I'm on the wrong radio program. I'm on the wrong TV program. How could I dare to have a conversation with that person? It just doesn't stop. So to me, I'm hopeful that the better angels of our personality are emerging across the board, and we're going to try to find, if you will, pharmaceuticals that can help us with COVID-19. But I'd love to see us find a vaccine as well. But on the other hand, when the vaccine, if we get one, I'm certainly hopeful that there's choice involved, because people are very fearful that government might come in and say, okay, here we are. If you want to be able to go to a grocery store, go to a public place, show us your credentials that you had the vaccine. Really? Is that where we're going to go? That's dangerous. That sounds like Orwellian thinking.
Yeah, well, just in Massachusetts, just recently, they just announced, yeah, I'm sure, and that's where I live. I live in Massachusetts. They announced that they're going to mandate the flu vaccine, which to me is just crazy, because, I mean, there's some years it's only 20% effective or less or whatever, because the virus obviously is always changing. But to make it mandatory, to me, it just seems crazy. And I don't even see the correlation between how that would affect with the current issue at hand. Do you know the logic in all that? And also, do you have an opinion on that?
I think the logic is there's going to be a perfect storm conceivably in October, November, December, when we see the routine influenza come into our population, we continue to have COVID-19 in our population, and then throw into the mixture strep throat, because those are we generally see a lot of flu and strep, and you know, mix in a little pneumonia. But in this situation, we're going to have COVID-19. And I believe the thought is that if everybody would get an influenza vaccine, that might take one of those bad players out of that mix. So we'd have COVID-19 or strep, or COVID-19 maybe deteriorating into pneumonia syndromes, or having pneumonia caused by strep or staph. But it would give us a little bit of stratification. And do I buy into that? I can't, and not on a mandatory basis, because quite frankly, the flu vaccine has such a mediocre reputation. Dr. Osterholm said once, and he maybe rused the day he said this, but he did say it. He said, the flu vaccine is not that good, but it's the only thing we've got. Well, you could say the same thing about if someone had a hangnail and you needed to try to clean it up with a scalpel, but you didn't have one, and all you had was a hatchet. And you said, well, a hatchet isn't a very good way to approach this ingrown toenail, but it's all we got. So you're going to chop off the toe? That doesn't make any sense. I apologize to Dr. Osterholm for using his name in vain. But he's a big boy. He can handle it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who weren't that intrigued or even involved with the vaccine conversation is much more involved now. They're much more aware. And I think this is more of a, you know, I always say, I'm like, it's not an anti-vaccine, pro-vaccine battle. It should be a freedom and rights and rights over your own body and the freedom to do what you want with your own body. I mean, that's what the conversation should be. And if you talk to most people who get pigeonholed as a anti-vaxxer, most of them will say that. And the same way your story and your information was being suppressed and kind of spun certain ways in the media, same thing with a lot of anybody who goes against the grain with the vaccine debate, you know. And I mean, tomorrow I'm going to have Dr. Brian Hooker on, who I'm sure you're familiar with him, with you know, he was one of the guys that helped expose the CDC whistleblower story with Dr. William Thompson. But you know, it is one of those things where, like, if you say anything against the grain, the media will immediately attack you. And in regards to, like, your personal experience with the media and you coming out publicly doing interviews, and what did you learn from the media? Do you think that there's any example of them actually caring about your story and what you had to say, or was it more about using you as a weapon to either demonize one side or promote the other?
That's a great question. I think that my experience in talking with so many of media sources, whether it be radio, TV, mainstream media, newspapers, it's been positive. Now, some have certainly been mean-spirited to me. I thought that we had a good conversation, and then I read the reporter. I saw the way they sliced and diced it, and I thought, holy cow, I sound like a knucklehead. And that happens. But overall, you know, the only thing that really bothered me is people get so compartmentalized. I know that I was on Fox News. I can't tell you how many people that challenged me for, how could you do that? I said, what do you mean? I said, Fox News is a highly reputable, huge reporter of the news. It was my pleasure to go on and share my perspective. And they said, well, that leans right. And I said, I'd be glad to be on CNN, which I understand leans left. I made comments to many people. I'd love to have a conversation with some of the folks from CNN. We can have a conversation, but it seems like because I was already compartmentalized, I wasn't given that chance. I remember when BBC Radio out of London contacted me, said, you know, you want to come on for an interview? I said, sure. I didn't know BBC leans left, but that's what I was told later. I was glad to have a conversation. We had a good conversation. I am not interested in being political. I'm interested in trying to provide some context so people aren't so fearful. I think that as a doc in the trenches and as a policymaker in the Senate, I do have the ability to help connect the dots. I think we are being fed a load of baloney at times, and people want to know how to separate and sort that out, and it's hard. It's hard to read medical studies. Reading medical studies is sort of like, for me, trying to read legal contract stuff. That's not my wheelhouse. So I feel overall it's been a pretty positive experience. Yes, some people have been mean, but for the most part, I think I can handle myself in an interview. And if someone asks me a leading question that they might, I can tell they want me to go somewhere that I'm not comfortable going, I'll just say, you know, I'm going to take a pass on that. That's more conjecture than it is fact. And I don't want to misrepresent myself. I don't want to have the Board of Medical Practice come interrogating and investigating me again. So I'm probably a little bit more careful than I used to be. I will say this. I did not know of some of these sources where, I guess, and I apologize if I say the names wrong, but there's a thing called infomercial, not InfoWars. And there's another thing called QAnon. I had never heard of these things. But evidently, my face and my name and some of my comments were used. Well, I don't know how I stopped that. These people, this is social media. I don't think I own the rights to it. They never contacted me. They can use what they want, and they do. And I think that we have to all remember that. And if from this show that we're doing together here, someone clips something out that makes me sound like I'm some hard right conspiracy guy, I don't know how I get to stop that.
I think that's why the long form conversation is so important, is because you can actually, you have time to lay out your opinions and perspectives. And like, I don't edit anything out unless somebody says, hey, do you mind cutting this out? I didn't want to say that or whatever. Which I think has only happened once and out of, you know, 260 shows. But I think the type of platform that Fox News, CNN, you know, where you have seconds to put out complex ideas and opinions, like, it's just primitive to me. It doesn't give you time to really, and it's very easy, like you said, if you just misspeak or you say something that they can twist a certain way, you know, you don't have any time to kind of correct that. And that's a huge issue. That's why I think podcasts have become so popular. I mean, InfoWars, QAnon, I'm with you. I'm not with you. I know what they are because I'm kind of in this alternative media world. But I don't join any team. I'm with you. I've had people on like Greg Palast, who actually works for the BBC and leans left. And I've had, you know, G. Edward Griffin, who leans right and is more of a libertarian type thinker. I've had Scott Horton on, and I've had, Professor Richard Wolff, who's a Marxist, or, you know, studies Marxism, you know, so it to me, it's like, I like exploring ideas, and I don't like to be pigeonholed, and I think people need to be much more open to the fact that, like, okay, just because, you know, Fox News is reporting on this doctor, it doesn't mean that the doctor's right wing or he agrees with everything the Fox News says. Just listen to what he says. You see it all the time where people will share an article and before they read anything on an article, they'll discredit its source. Like, oh, that comes from that website or that comes from that. I'm like, okay, but is the information wrong? Like, there's going to be times where a Republican, maybe not for moral reasons, exposes some corruption on the left. Maybe the only purpose is to make the left look bad. But if they expose some corruption, isn't that still good? And vice versa, same thing. If somebody on the left is just trying to expose some corruption on the right for the only purpose is to make them look bad. But if it's exposing some corruption, isn't that still good? Like, to me, it's like this idea of like dismissing everything and not actually having the discussion solely just because you don't like who's having the discussion, to me is silly.
I have to acknowledge that I have never in my life until this year looked up on internet the bias of a news source, whether it be a podcast, a TV show, a radio. And I now find myself putting in the Google box bias, and then I list it. There was one today, a medical journal, and it was an excellent article on the confusion in testing with PCR testing. And I thought the article was well written. I thought, well, I better check out and find out where it sits on this bias scale. And yeah, I think you make a very good point. And thank you for running the kind of podcast that doesn't slice and dice and instead allows the long thought to be elaborated on. Because I know sometimes people may not listen to the whole podcast, but it really, especially if you get a chance to cut it into sections. So when we talk about topics, people can hear what you and I had to say on a given topic. Because that does help. And I think it does broaden the conversation.
Yeah. Well, I need to find time to do that. Because you're right. That's very useful. Like, people just, when you're having an hour or 2 hour in some cases conversation, it does help for people to take a little part of the conversation they liked, clip it out, and then people can just hear that part. And maybe if they're intrigued with the conversation, go back and listen to the whole thing. But you're right. We live very busy lives. So I know people are kind of limited on time sometimes. But so I know you're speaking of very busy, I know you're very busy, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I know the mask thing is a very hot topic, and just recently my son started soccer again. You know, thank God that there's even programs that continue continuing, and a lot of these programs, martial arts classes, soccer, all this stuff, are requiring kids to wear masks. What's your opinion on that? And I know some people say, hey, it's the science says this. Other people say the science is settled. What's your overall opinion on masks? Do you think it's something, it's a little too far? Is it overstepping? Do you think that it maybe would help in spreading, the virus?
I think that several thoughts would emerge for me. One would be, I don't think the science is settled. I think that what we talked for the last 20 years prior to COVID-19 has been sort of thrown by the wayside. And earlier I mentioned that it's been done so without the benefit of randomized controlled trials and double-blinded studies and peer review. So I think that in the next few years, hopefully we'll get a chance to revisit this issue. But this issue has been visited previously. It was visited after the swine flu of 2009, after the Ebola. We have looked at this. And if you look at the physics of masks, surgical cotton masks, N95 masks, things like that, and you look at the pore size, and I won't bore you with the details, but the fact of the matter is the physics would tell you that the masks are not going to provide the kind of support or protection that you would want in order for it to be, if you will, one of the mainstays of our approach. I think physical distancing, yeah, there's value there. But again, if you look at the literature in other countries other than the US, 6 feet isn't necessarily the magic number. Many places have studied 1 meter, which is 39 inches. I think one of the most important things we can tell people to do is don't touch your eyes, nose, and mouth. We know that that's the best way to spread this disease. And yet that's exactly what we do more of when we wear masks. And when we're not used to wearing masks, we're going to touch our nose, our eyes, our mouth even more. So when we have kids playing soccer, we know they're going to cough, sneeze, bark, shout, and they're going to have spittle and droplets all over, and they're going to be touching their masks and all that. If you have two soccer players running by each other at 4 miles an hour trying to kick a ball, I'm not too worried about them spreading the disease from one another and stopping and exchanging viral particles. If you want to have people wear a mask on the sidelines, if we're going to have masks in so many other places, fine. But again, I don't think the science is settled on this. I'm glad that they're letting soccer players play, but I think that if we ask soccer players to perform, I don't care what age you're talking about, with masks in place, we are going to see some adverse medical catastrophes. It will happen. I think that the idea that that we're doing this to kids, when we know that kids, virtually the case fatality rate in many areas of the country, statistically, for people under the age of 40, is zero. So really, I think we could let the kids have a little bit more of a normalcy in their existence than what we're doing. We could have the coaches wear a mask and a shield and pull the mask down if he or she's got to talk to someone who's hearing impaired. But gee whiz, what we're doing to the kids is going to be a lasting legacy. And we're going to learn over the next months and years of some of the unintended consequences of our actions. And we're going to be a little embarrassed, just as we should be embarrassed by the decisions made when we created a pipeline of active COVID-19 disease from the hospital into the nursing home. And then once we infiltrated the nursing home and the people living there, once we got them the disease, then we did the one final step. We said, oh, by the way, if you're dying from this, you'll have to die alone, because we can't let anybody in. This is going to be remembered for decades.
Yeah, I think I actually had a cousin who passed away during the height of the lockdown. And same thing, he couldn't have a proper funeral. His family couldn't even go see him at the hospital. It was sad. It was just like, the only way you could make such a sad situation worse is preventing any real closure, It's obviously that's just one case, and there's many stories. And I think the long-term effects of this, we can't even imagine what negative effects is going to have on our society. I mean, my daughter the other day was pretending she worked at, she was playing with like a fake register, a toy register, and she's like, oh, and she puts on a mask. I'm like, what are you doing? Because I'd never make my kids wear masks ever, right? So my wife bought one and it's laying around the house, and she put it on and she's like, oh, I'm pretending I work at the store. And I'm like, this is like deep rooted into their psychology. I'm like, this has become normal to them. And to me, it's like, I don't want to accept this, because I think the longer this goes, the more accepting people are of it. Like, okay, well, this is just the way things are. And there's so much conflicting opinion. We talked about science. I mean, you want to talk about, science. I mean, the science, you're right. It's natural for it to never be settled, because we're always learning new things or whatnot. But in regards to this, you know, some people say, oh, if you're asymptomatic, you can carry it. And then they say, if you are asymptomatic, you can't carry it. Then they say that the sun kills it. Then they say the sun doesn't kill. So a lot of people are just throwing their hands up and like, I don't know what to believe, so I'm just going to play it safe, you know, and they're accepting all this stuff. And like you said, when kids, I mean, this year alone, I'm pretty sure, and people can look it up, but I'm pretty sure that the regular flu has killed more young kids than COVID-19. I mean, it like you said, for young kids, it's drastically not dangerous at all. It really doesn't do much to anything of them. I guess the argument would be to be maybe a listener who might be saying, hey, well, can't they carry it to a older person who they could put at risk? Is there concerns about that? Is that something people should think about?
I think we're still looking into the whole concept of transmission through aerosols. And if so, when someone is asymptomatic but would test positive for a COVID-19 with a PCR test, would they be able to transmit through aerosol? The World Health Organization has spoken to this. The CDC has. Unfortunately, the message being shared isn't the same. I know that there was a highly regarded individual at World Health Organization that made some comments and was absolutely demonized for her comments. So I think that we're still learning on that. But what we do know is that this virus really, in terms of serious disease, leaves kids alone.
Yeah, I mean, a huge percentage of people were in nursing homes. A huge percent of people were, I mean, respirators, I think, have a part to do with that. You know, maybe the overuse of respirators. So there's a lot of things that, like you said, we're still trying to figure out. I mean, I guess that's the thing that bothers me, is so many people just act like they've already, like, oh, no, it's settled. It's this, it's that. And it's really because if your news station, whatever one you watch, says this is settled and for whatever political purpose they have, that's the information you go with. But, you know, to me, like I said, I try to give people a platform to kind of explore all ideas and opinions, and it's really bothersome when people can't get all the information to make a logical, informative decision on how to live their lives or what policies they want to go with. I mean, you've been in politics. You know that once you give them a little bit of power, they don't give it back. And when you're seeing this overreach, you know, it's like, first we have to flatten the curve, then we have to do this, and then if we just lock down for a little, oh, but we didn't do it correctly, so let's just do it a little longer, let's do this. It's like, it seems endless. And a lot of people are saying maybe it's, you know, because they don't want people going to the polls to vote, so they have to kind of keep the scare. I mean, you're hearing a lot of conversation about cases. You're not hearing a lot about deaths anymore, which should be a positive thing, but yet it's still freaking people out. But yeah, I mean, I can't thank you enough for your courage to be outspoken and to say what you see and how you feel, and without being worried about, you know, any backlash or how people are going to take it. We need more people like you. I mean, I consider you kind of a whistleblower, a death certificate whistleblower, and I always have a soft spot for whistleblowers. I've had Thomas Drake on and many others, and you know, I think it always makes me think, like, if I was in their position, I want to believe I would do the same thing. But how many of us really would have the courage to deal with the extra stress on their lives that you probably don't need already as a doctor?
Well, to that point, I would say two things. I'd say one is, some of these crucial conversations that you're promoting, and many others are as well, I say thank you for doing that. I think within the context of a crucial conversation, it's okay to have tension. I think tension is that back and forth. It's that Socratic questioning that goes on. But tension is a lot different than vehement demonization of someone's perspective if it's not your own. And that's what we need to be on guard about. And in terms of, if you will, being a whistleblower, I was disappointed initially that there weren't more physicians coming forward saying, Doc Jensen's right. But I did learn over the weeks and months after I raised the concern regarding death certificates that around the state of Minnesota and around the country and literally around the globe, there were thousands of doctors reaching out to me saying, you were right. The sequence of causation in a death certificate has to be of the greatest importance. And thanks for speaking up on that. And I think in learning that, it was rewarding. I think one of the reasons why, again, I don't think people should see me as particularly courageous, because it's easy to be courageous, I think, in the world of politics if you don't want to be a politician. And I do not like being called a politician. I'm a family doctor. I work in the trenches. I got the best patients in the world. Please don't call me a politician. And if there's something that I'm doing that's going to compromise my political future, hey, that's okay.
Yeah.
Have a great day, Ricardo. I've had a good time talking.
Hey, you too. Thank you, Dr. Jensen. Hopefully we reconnect sometime in the future. But keep up the great work. And like I said, I really appreciate everything you're doing.
Thanks much.
Hey, thank you. Take care.